Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics. Ray, we need to talk about automation.
Yes, automation. How do we do things more quickly, at greater scale, for a lower cost? Yeah, this seems to be the primary goal of our societies these days. I'm not sure that anyone really asked for it, but it feels like that's kind of like the default setting. You know, we want growth, productivity. These terms come in, and these things are supported by automation, essentially. You know, and people are looking to grow productivity and grow things through automation. And it feels like some kind of like growth and automation are very much linked. We've seen that through the Industrial Revolution. But there seems to be, these days, it seems to be fetishized, I would say, where automation is kind of coming everywhere. We're very happy, of course, if we have our washing done through an automated washing machine. This is nice. But more and more of our life is becoming automated, and there's more and more like smart homes and stuff like this. You know, there's a kind of like creeping automation of our lives. And obviously at work, we're getting more and more automated.
Right.
So the question is, I mean, I think what we're going to talk about is it right? You know, do we really right. need to automate right. all this shit? And let's just zoom out a little bit to find out whether or not automation, this fetishism and this like this praise and exaltation, I would say, of automation, is it a good thing? And, you know, how is it affecting us as people? And then obviously we're going to talk about how AI is related to that.
Yeah, definitely. So why don't we just, as you said, zoom out, rewind, if you will, and get really specific about what we mean when we say automation. So at its simplest, automation really is basically using machines to do work instead of people. Like at its root, yeah. that's yeah, what yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. So automation is sold to us as an unalloyed good, basically as a way to reduce toil and tedium in our lives, right? That is kind of how it's sold to us. And how does automation actually work, though? So you start out with an activity, and you know, let's stick on washing machines, because this is a pretty easy one. You take an activity such as washing your clothes, and you need to turn that activity into a process that is repeatable. So what you do is you break that down into steps or discrete tasks, if you will. You effectively write those down. And then you figure out how to create a machine or a computer program that can do those tasks and can do those tasks every time and removes kind of all the variability of a human actually doing this activity. So I would say that's what's required for automation. And the next question is, again, like, what's so bad about that, Ray? This sounds good so far, right?
I mean, yeah, I mean, the idea of having a reduction in the amount of labor that you do to get on to live your life, it seems very good. I mean, I think that's true. The problem with it's difficult to argue against washing machines, by the way. I mean, you know, that's a steel man argument for automation. I really believe that, you know.
I like it.
But there's so many parts of automation that feel like, well, you know, do we really need to automate these bits? And right. is it a good thing? And again, maybe it's a rabbit hole here a little bit, but when I was growing up in the 1940s, the washing machines that we had were like washing tubs, they called them. They didn't even have a spinner, you know? We didn't have like a spin dryer. Spin dryers were something that came later. And now we have like things that dry, tumble dryers and this kind of stuff that dry the clothes as well. So there's the whole aspect of laundry, you know, of, well, you know, you wear your clothes once for some reason, and then you immediately put it into the washing machine.
Right.
So I feel like automation just changes to some extent. I know we're going to talk about that a bit more, but our behavior is changed somewhat mm-hmm. by it.
Yeah.
And also the degree of automation is changing, constantly changing. So when like I said, when I was growing up, we didn't have spinners. We had like these mangles. They were called mangles. So there were at a certain point they were automated, where you could feed sheets through the mangles. And this is a horrific story, by the way. My sister actually had her hand caught in a mangle and had terrible scars on her arm. So automation in a home can be dangerous. So I didn't mean to. to bring that up, actually, but yeah, it's sort of like that's a strange memory that just popped up there. Anyway, yeah, I feel like automation in the washing machine in that scope of the washing machine has moved from that open thing with no spinning, but this like a mangle, to now this like machine which has a computer in it that might talk back to some. You know, some German company or some American company or some Japanese company about, you know, what you're washing. So I feel like our automation in general to reduce the burden is definitely very good. But the degree of automation, the type of automation is definitely problematic, I'd say, or contentious at least, or it should be contestable.
Yeah.
How far we go with automation, how far do we fetishize it? And it's very difficult to stop, by the way. I think that's the other thing. It's very difficult to say no to more convenience. I think that's maybe something that's worth saying.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one point you made in there that I really want to kind of drill down on is that automation, I believe automation is harmful by default, actually.
Right.
And I think the story you told, you know, about your sister getting her arm caught in an automated sheet washing machine, again, who wouldn't want a machine to remove the toil of washing your sheets? Sounds good, right? But how is this machine implemented? How is this automation implemented? How is the machine built? What safeguards are put in place to avoid harm being done?
Yeah.
And I think we should get into that more. But one thing that you said to me before that I found really interesting is kind of automation of fishing, which seems like, you know, off the top of my head, that seems like something. What do you mean automation of fishing? So tell us about fishing, Ray. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, I think fishing is a bit like washing, you know. Well, actually, I don't know. I would say fishing is more necessary than washing, you know. Washing clothes. Washing clothes seems like, yeah, it feels like that's a second order problem, let's say, you know, because you need to eat. But the thing about fishing that's interesting, I feel like, is that obviously, yeah, we need to eat, and fishing in the old days was a way of getting protein.
Right.
It still is for a lot of people, obviously.
Yeah.
When we were like in pre-agricultural times, even fishing was a way to get extra protein. The people of the village would go to the river and, you know, catch fish in various ways. And the interesting thing about that to me was that it required some knowledge of the river, some knowledge of nature, some knowledge of the fish themselves. And this was knowledge that the village had, that it was shared knowledge among the people.
Right.
They needed to know, there's certain times of year where the river is stocked. There are certain rivers that are stocked. At certain times of the year, there are certain fish that come, you know, and each fish might require a slightly different trapping mechanism and different technologies as well, actually. Sometimes you can put barriers in the way and catch them just by picking them out the river. And others, you might have to use a line, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, we know how fishing works at a sort of small scale. But these days, fishing is mostly just a hobby. You know, no one uses fishing or very few people use fishing on a line to actually feed themselves. You know, it's a kind of like TV porn where you get these guys going on fishing trips, and it's a nostalgic, reminiscent type thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a romanticized, I would say, and like much of automation, it's romanticized. People talk about farming in general. It's a very romanticized image about a farm. Automating or like scaling up the fishing industry, that's been incredibly damaging. You don't have to think about, or the people who are eating fish now, we're living in a society where we don't have to think about how do we get our fish, what's the effect of fishing, where do we look for, all that stuff is gone. It's concentrated in a few specialists.
Yeah.
The people who do the trawling, or the people that do the sort of the factory fishing out at sea,
right.
All these kind of things. So we're devolving into a bunch of specialists, and we don't know about how our food is made, or we can find out if we really want to look, but we can afford to be incurious about that. So that has shifted the way that we relate to nature, I would say, where we used to take a more fully rounded kind of view of things as a society. The automation of these things narrows our perspectives, and it narrows the groups that actually conduct that fishing. And we essentially just eat the fish now, or you know, we just eat right. the fish, or eat the beef, or whatever we do. You know, we just consume the result of these activities. We don't know about what's going on. And I feel like that process of automating and scaling these things, which were once known to us, has an effect on us. It allows us not to think about it. And then the people that are thinking about it are obsessed with scale, productivity, automation. Mm-hmm. And that detaches them and us from the process of like overfishing, for example, or factory farming, all of these kind of like difficult conversations that we might have are kind of cornered off somewhere.
Yeah.
And we become powerless, I would say, even to have those conversations.
Yeah. I think there are kind of a bunch of things you sprinkled in there. And one thing
sorry about that.
Hey, I mean, that's why we're talking, right? You know, to explore ideas. So I think one of the points you made there is you said we don't have to know or care about where the fish come from. You know, we are separated from this holistic aspect. And when you say we, I mean, we're talking about you, me, people like us, people living in kind of global north or whatever post-industrial societies, whatever you want to call it, right? We are the people who are basically going to the supermarket to get our food. And, you know, you made a point about like, well, what does that do to us? And I think, honestly, I think there's so much there. And I want to spend kind of a full conversation just drilling into that because I think we can connect directly, you know, automation of our food supply to AI, to large language models. And I think there's so much interesting stuff there. So I'm going to pin that and kind of leave it for our next conversation, maybe. But there were a few other things in there. You talked about the harms done. You talked about scale. And again, I just want to reiterate that I think automation defaults to doing harm. And as we scale up that automation, the harms get worse because, you know, as you were saying about fishing, basically the way that we as humanity used to fish, it was a very individual thing, or, you know, maybe a small group of people went out to fish. But they knew what they were doing. They were aware of the limits of the ecosystem. They were aware of the various conditions of the river. So they were able to limit the amount of harm they were doing because they had total control over their actions, right? But as you scale up a process and as you make it more general, as you automate more things, you know, now you're having a bigger and bigger effect on the environment. So that's one way in which automation leads to harm. And again, as you mentioned, this is done in the name of growth. And the question, though, is like, is growth sustainable, right?
Yeah, I think this is that's the thing, isn't it? That when we're doing things at a relatively small scale, obviously there were fewer humans back in the day, then it was sustainable by default.
Exactly.
And now we kind of like went crazy. Obviously the population exploded. We got the Industrial Revolution. We know the history. And, you know, now we're looking at 8 billion people on the planet. Of course, you know, some things have to scale. You know, we've scaled and sure. the systems have to scale. But I agree with you that it is harmful by default. And the question is, like, how do you address that? I mean, you know, people talk now about sustainability and about sustainable productions and things like this. So it's good that we're having those conversations. But like you say, by default, it's not. So that, I mean, the very fact that we're having a conversation about sustainability means that by default, it isn't sustainable.
Yeah.
And it's already a kind of awkward conversation because we have these feelings or we have this, and it's kind of like, again, a narrative that we have this like infinite set of resources
right.
that are completely exploitable, that we have abundance everywhere. And I don't want to get into this abundance discussion because it's very galling, but it is apropos this concept of infinite resources and infinite scale. And again, this does touch upon the things we've talked about previously about going off planet and stuff like this.
Exactly.
So, you know, we need to limit ourselves to be sustainable. We need to think about these things, about how we can reduce the harm of our existence. And that's the thing that's changed through automation, I would say.
Yeah.
I agree with you completely that automation, it has this initial appeal of reducing toil, yet at the same time, it's had this displacement effect, this displacing effect of removing responsibility and
exactly.
Even thinking, I would say, you know, the actual thought process. And obviously we're going to talk about AI in terms of removing thought processes. And it feels like that's what's happening with automation in general.
Yeah. And so I think, again, another interesting thing that you just raised there is this narrative of sustainability. And I think if we just look again, if we go back to kind of factory fishing, I think there's something really interesting there that we've kind of moved to farming salmon. And at least in my supermarket, the farmed salmon is marketed as this is the sustainable alternative to overfishing. And I think if you look at how salmon farming actually works, there's another interesting aspect of automation that's happening there. So first of all, like you're removing variability and making this predictable. So no longer are you affected by, you know, seasonal conditions. Perhaps this river, for whatever reason, you know, doesn't support the salmon population swimming upstream and spawning. So by creating a salmon farm, which is basically just a big netted off area in the sea, all of a sudden now you always have the supply of salmon you need. But that supply of salmon, the quality there is not equivalent to a wild salmon, right? Caught in the wild because of the conditions of that salmon. So I think what we're looking at is automation's effect on quality as well.
Can I interrupt you just one second about the farming there?
Yeah.
Because I think there's an interesting point about the salmon farming, which is that what happens is when people get into like producing salmon in these nets, an intensification occurs. And I think maybe we should talk about intensifying stuff because what happens is that you have to spend, let's say you have to spend 100,000 euros on getting these nets and these pools. So you have to have some capital to develop these netted pools that will serve a community with these salmon. And then what happens is people want returns on investment. So rather than just having, like, let's say 1,000 salmon in there, they have 2,000. And then they discover, oh, okay, maybe we can have 5,000 here.
Right.
Now, what is the effect of, like, moving from 1,000 to 5,000 salmon? Well, it's not nothing. You know, you have to feed more of them. Okay, that's fair enough. That's easy. That's just an input cost. But how are these salmon actually living? You know, they're now packed in. They can barely move around each other, and they're used to being free in the ocean. Now, I'm not here to spend all the time talking about, like, the sort of the cruelty of salmon. Although I do find that hurts my heart. You know,
yeah.
You imagine that these creatures, noble creatures, are treated so poorly, but. It's partly about us as well as consumers. Now we're getting substandard salmon, like you say. The salmon that we were getting, like, in these days where it was caught in the river, they were healthier. They were free of all these antibiotics and all these kind of things.
Exactly.
All the kind of things that are required to scale things up and to farm more intensively and more efficiently. All of those things are done to those fish and to that ocean as well. There's all pollution coming out of that ocean, which might be harmful to all the ecosystems around the pools. So there's all kinds of stuff that happens around intensifying and scaling production that are harmful, like you say. That's where it defaults, and we try to forget about those things, those externalities.
Exactly.
We're coming back to that externality again.
Classic, yeah.
You know. Yeah, we just want to ignore the externality and just think about the fish in the supermarket.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, it's a really good point, and one worth kind of just repeating over and over until it becomes as natural as breathing to us, which is that, you know, kind of the incentives all push toward increasing automation, increasing efficiency, increasing profit, because you have to have continuous profit growth, right? Year over year growth. It's not enough to have profit. That profit has to grow. So, and I think that's a great point that you made about the harms being done all along the kind of production chain, if you will. You know, the harms being done to the animals in factory farming. You know, the stuff is unspeakably cruel. The reason that you have to introduce these antibiotics is, again, because, as you said, the fish are packed in so densely that all of the natural safeguards against disease transmission are gone.
Yeah.
So we need to pump in antibiotics to make sure that they live to, you know, harvestable size. And I'm using that word harvestable, like, in an intentional way, because this is, we're reducing these wild animals to something that is just harvested for food, and we're completely taking away every other aspect of their life. These antibiotics then also cause harm in us, the consumers, right? Because they lead to antibiotic resistant bacteria and this and that and the other. Also, as you mentioned, the harms to the environment. And if we go back to quality, so we are getting lower quality fish on average, right? And I think the difference here is when you had individual fishers, if they caught a salmon that was not fit for eating, if it was too small or if it was sick or something, you know, that human made a decision there, okay, I'm going to return the salmon that's too small to the ocean, or this salmon is sick, you know, it actually can't live, but we're not going to eat it, right? You have that decisioning process there. And again, by automation, what's happening is you're removing the human from the loop. So the human has no autonomy to make a decision about quality. And so again, what you're effectively doing is smoothing out the quality curve. So you are, let's say we have someone who's fishing who is unscrupulous and only cares about profit. So they're just going to still bring the sick fish to market and sell them, right? They're just going to, whatever they catch. And then on the other end, you have the fisher who really cares about, you know, the quality of the fish that they're bringing back. They want to make sure the people eating these fish are getting, you know, something that is delicious, that's not going to harm them. And so with factory fishing, what you're doing is you're smoothing out that quality curve and you're maybe raising the floor, right? But you're also lowering the ceiling. So what you get with the quality curve is something that's, you know, maybe not a complete straight line, but it's pretty close. And I would argue with, as opposed to fishing, if you look at something like, you know, garment production, then you have a process that's pretty much completely repeatable, completely devoid of variability. You know, if you feed in inputs of a uniform quality, you get out outputs of a uniform quality. Therefore, like every shirt of the same type, every t-shirt is the same quality.
What I was going to say just quickly about the quality thing is that people say there's a race to the bottom. So there are like problems here. But I agree that, you know, in certain areas like cloth manufacturing, you can imagine that the floor is being raised. I'm not so sure about food manufacturing. I feel like the floor, I think the floor is being lowered, actually. I think actively lowered. I mean, really, I'm not joking about this, because now with factory farming and even dairy productions, people are allowed to put into the system more dangerous things, you know, chlorinated chicken, this kind of stuff. They're allowed to put in active poisons to the system, which, you know, I don't see how you can say that that has even raised the floor. This feels like an active corruption of the system.
What I'm thinking about is maybe more ideal conditions, but I think what you're pointing to very incisively there is like, okay, let's stipulate for a second that the floor is raised in the beginning, but it feels like the floor always slopes inexorably downwards, right? Because the way to grow profit is to reduce costs, reduce waste. If I can feed in cheaper inputs, that makes more profit for me, but also then the quality of the output is going to suffer. So I think that's something really interesting that you're pointing to there.
Yeah, I don't think there's no way to magically improve quality without accepting that things are going to go a bit slower. And if we want to reduce the externalities, then we have to do things differently that might cost a little bit more.
Right.
So I think, again, you know, sustainability is about how do we do things at a larger scale with a lower impact.
Right.
So these things are definitely possible, but they will reduce the profitability.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's a really important aspect of the conversation to cover, because we're living in a sort of society at the moment, at least, which is still hungering after profits more than it's hungering after sustainability.
Exactly. And I think,
by the way, I'm lying about that. I don't think society is, I want to rephrase that. Society is not hungering after profits over sustainability. I think as a population, we know that we want sustainability.
Right.
But the owners or the
owners of the means of production, there you go.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
The
people in control of the companies, let's say, that are owning these factories.
I said, the people who hold the levers of society,
right?
The politicians and the sort of the corporate overlords. And again, government and corporate overlords are kind of fusing at this point, where, you know, we would wish that our governments and corporations would be separate.
One thing I wanted to point to here, though, is that there are, not only is there no incentive to raise quality, there is an incentive to reduce it. And it's not just because you want to increase your profit, it's not just because by making the cost of producing a good cheaper, you increase your profit there, you increase your profit margin. But it's also, once you hit scale, I've sold my product to every available consumer, right? I've sold everyone a washing machine, a refrigerator.
Shit,
I've created a problem for myself. But if I make a low quality product that only lasts 10 years, well, in 10 years, I can just sell them a new one. So there are active incentives to make lower quality goods at scale.
Right. Yeah, that's very well put, actually. The more, it's almost like the more successful anything becomes, it automatically leads to a degradation.
Exactly. And I think this is something that we actually know as a society. We know what the problems with factories are. And, you know, where you do have an incentive for quality is if I am a startup company trying to disrupt the incumbent, if I'm trying to disrupt the market, if I'm trying to take market share away from these incumbents, you know, now I have incentive to come out with a product that is much higher quality than theirs to get my wedge in. But once again, as I scale up as a company, now all of a sudden my incentives move toward, you know, again, lowering the quality. And, you know, we go round and round on this merry-go-round. But I'm just wondering, like, what is this reduction in quality? What is this knowledge that you're making a poor quality product? You know, what's happening to the actual workers in these factories?
I think what we're talking about now is like automation in general and like the means of production and all these kind of things. And what we're not coming towards is the people that are participating in that process.
Right.
The discussion so far is about the people who are essentially orchestrating the process, investing in the process, and gaining benefit from the process in terms of their wealth. But what we haven't talked about yet is the people that are working in these environments, that are actually, you know, doing the work on a daily, that are working in the sweatshops,
right,
that are working in the factories to produce various, you know, cars, whatever. And I think it's clear that, and you made the point earlier on about processes. What happens in factories is that, like in a washing machine, there's a sort of set of processes. And what happens is in a factory, each of those processes are broken down and given to like a team or an individual. So you have machines supporting these teams, supporting this individual to do a certain part of the process. But they don't like, nobody in a car factory makes a car.
Right.
You know, they're responsible for fitting a gearbox. And if you're in a biscuit factory, you're responsible for making sure the boxes are filled with biscuits, those kind of things. You know, you're not actually making a biscuit. You're not making a car. So there is a what many economists, a wise man once called alienation.
Right.
And alienation is about this disconnect between the work that a factory overall produces, this mm-hmm. car or these biscuits or these spanners or whatever. The people in the factory are completely alienated from their work is not meaningful. Their work is not producing a chair or producing a car even. It's not producing this complicated thing. It's being a small cog in a bigger system. And we're not like that. Not normally, naturally, as humans, we want to be creative. We want to see the whole thing. We want to contextualize things. We want to, if we're going to produce something, we want to produce the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's the essence of creativity and art and that kind of stuff. But in the factory, those things are stolen from us. We're just doing it for money now. It's purely, you know, and I think this is where you get into all of this, you know, industrial disputes, which we can just leave on the table somewhere else to be discussed in other forums. But disputes occur because workers don't really want to be there.
That's very true. So one really interesting point, well, you said two things that I want to tie together a little bit. So you said, first of all, we are alienated from the whole because no longer are we producing a chair, say.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing a tiny, tiny bit of the production of the chair. And you also said that in the factory, these machines are supporting teams. Mm. And I want to maybe examine that assertion, that statement that you made. Are machines really supporting the teams? So Let's step out of the factory for a second and talk about a woodworker who is making the entire chair, right? So who is connected through the entire...
The work,
yeah. They're connected to the work. They're making the chair from start to finish. They are in the modern era using power tools here, right? And I think power tools are a type of automation where they are actually supporting the artisan, right? So I have an automated saw, which, you know, reduces the toil of me sawing by hand, of me making sure that I am cutting in a straight line, all of these things. But this is a tool that is serving me definitely. So in a way, like, we can look at this type of automation, what you're creating is a centaur. So the head of a human and machine bodies that actually do help me in my work. But if you look at the factory, what you're doing is you're swapping that around. So you have a reverse centaur where the machine itself is the brain and the humans in a factory are subservient to the machines.
Right,
because what they do is, like, they're standing on an assembly line, say machine number one spits out some outputs. A human does some little fiddly thing that's too difficult to automate, too expensive to automate. And then they feed that into machine number two, but they have to do that, you know, 20 times per minute or whatever, because the machine says so, because that's how fast the conveyor belt is moving. And I know that you've worked actually for Toyota, and they had a slightly different approach to this factory automation. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything about their approach for a minute.
Well, I mean, I obviously things evolve. It's been a long time since I've worked there, so I'm not going to speak. I mean, I don't speak for them, you know.
No, of course not. Of course not.
But I think, you know, the factories that I visited, certain aspects of the process were fully automated. For instance, like pressing sheet metal or like forming certain parts of the car body, those would be fully automated. Some of the spray painting would be automated. But many of the things would not be fully automated. There would be power tools, like you say. So if you wanted to, you know, fit a gearbox or fit a clutch or fit chairs or whatever, you know, you'd have power tools to fit bolts and these kind of things. And these are quite complicated machines, you know, where they automatically like measure the pressure that these bolts they're set to a certain torque. So there's a sort of mix there where I would say this like centaur thing doesn't quite work out, you know, in the sense that in car manufacturing, at least, it's a complicated mix of automation and manual processes. Now, the thing about some of the factories that the car companies have, I think this is true for some of the factories in Japan for Toyota, but I've never been there, are more automated. And the reason they do this is because there's a trade-off in capital terms. There's a trade-off between the cost of the robots and the cost of the humans. So in order to have sufficiently good quality coming out of the robots, that costs more money. And if the wages are high, then it's not worth it.
Right.
And a lot of car companies and a lot of companies in general will go to low-wage environments. That's how we see capitalism working in this sort of like recent 50, 70 years. You know, globalization is basically moving the production to the lowest price per human.
Yeah.
And then they automate less and they'd rely, like you say, more on kind of like cheap labor, essentially, to do the automation mm-hmm. for them. They know the process. They know what needs to be done. And they would rather, you know, invest or not invest, but actually enjoy the benefits of cheaper human labor than more expensive automaton labor. Because again, you know, these automation, the automation around factories, A, is quite complicated. You know, these tasks are very complicated. It needs people aren't like unskilled in factories. They need some training, they need some education, they need some skilling up.
So on the skilling up point, I think that's a really interesting one, because automation, as far as I know, of automotive factories was the first high scale automation we saw of cars was Ford. Back in the US, right?
Sure.
So Ford was the first company able to kind of mass produce automobiles. And this Ford model was really based on kind of Taylorist principles, where you tightly controlled the work. Everything was very prescriptive. The workers were just automatons, just following the process over and over and over. But Toyota's approach was a little different, right? Because they recognized that, as you said, these workers actually do need to be skilled and they do need to be trained. And so the workers themselves, Toyota realized, were the best place to understand how to improve a process because they were the ones hands-on with that process every day in the factory.
Yeah, I would say yes and no. I'd say that there was what happened, the big distinction between Chrysler, Ford, GM, and Toyota was that in the sort of 70s, 60s and 70s and 80s, let's say 60s and 70s, if you were making a car, there is a conveyor belt. You know, obviously, a car emerges from a whole bunch of like metal into this fully formed thing. And what happens is that everyone has the same kind of process, yeah, for putting car bodies together. You know, again, individual companies can refine that process according to their own innovations, but the general process is the same.
Right.
The difference is like what happens if you put the bed of the floor of a car together. If it's not done properly, you have to stop the line and take it back around. And stopping a line is really bad. That's what they all know, that stopping the line is bad, because as soon as you stop the line, it's very disruptive. You have to stop, move this part all the way back around. Everyone sort of drops their tools and all the productivity goes down. So what Toyota did was they said, okay, we'll slow it down. We'll slow things down. We'll make sure that whatever happens, the work that is done in one section cannot get passed on to another section until that team will essentially say this is good enough quality. And what happened was that a big distinction was that they said that that team, that group of people that were in that section of the factory, that team had responsibility for quality. And what they did was they essentially...
They were also empowered, though.
Yes, that's the point. They're empowered to say, we're going to stop. That's the idea, was that they dispersed the responsibility for quality to everyone in the company. And that's a very interesting challenge. The only reason I would say it's slightly different from the way you expressed it is that clearly the process is driven by... You know, the factory owners, there are factory makers,
yes.
Are process owners. And so all of these processes operate at different levels. So there's like the actual agreed process that is operating now. And some of the workers can indeed like say, okay, actually the bit that we are doing, we can improve slightly if we, you know, and again, this like concept of gradual improvement, continuous
right.
improvement is something that they took a lot of pride in. And so this idea of being able for that team to be able to say, okay, yeah, we can improve the quality here. This is all good. But they're only empowered in a very small part. I think we have to make that very clear that their power is very localized and very atomized even, I would say.
Right. I think one really interesting thing there is that the Toyota system, I mean, obviously got results in physical manufacturing.
Sure.
And it was then kind of moved into knowledge work, and it was valorized as this amazing thing where you return power to the workers. And as you just said, that's actually not true. You are doing that in extremely, you know, localized scale, in a sense.
Yeah.
Under a tight set of constraints. So I just want to then move into knowledge work, because knowledge work has historically been extremely difficult to automate.
Can I give you a link there?
Yeah.
Which is that we're talking about factories, and we had this guy, Mark Andreessen, talk about software eating the world. Well, I think now what's happening is that factories are eating the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And what's happening is that, you know, basically everything is a factory.
Yes.
And part of that, like you say, that part of that concept of Toyota's model moving into things like hospitals, law firms, and obviously software companies as well.
Yes.
But it's everywhere. You know, this concept of just in time, this, I mean, we can come reducing to a whole waste, like a whole thing of reducing, the whole thing about what the factory means, what the Toyota production system means. And the Toyota production system is for making cars. It's not for getting people better in hospital.
Right, exactly.
But again, I think, you know, we said at the beginning of this conversation about the fact that the goal of automation and productivity are aligned, or they're conflated at least. Mm-hmm. And there's a fetishism around this concept of, oh, if this factory is productive, if it's doing well, then let's just apply somehow, like, it doesn't matter whether it's applicable or not. Let's just apply that process to everything. And that's where we were seeing now is that, you know, there are ticketing systems everywhere. There are processes everywhere.
Yeah.
And this is really, I mean, it's really disheartening, I think. But what I feel like the disheartening part is not necessarily the process. I think we need processes.
Yep.
I think what's disheartening is this sort of general acceptance that it's, as you said before, it's an unalloyed good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you look at process, again, we're not saying that process in and of itself is bad. We're not even saying that automation in and of itself is bad. What we're saying is that process and automation need to be deployed as tools in service of us as humanity and not as ends in and of themselves, right? And I just want to talk about then how we got to this point where knowledge work, where we're able to have factories, you know, in software companies, whatever.
Right, yes.
So this was a problem, right? Because machines are, in factories, machines are purpose-built, right? They do one thing. And all of a sudden, along comes this thing called the computer, right? A digital computer which can run any program. So it is not it's not like a machine for stamping metal, right? Which only stamps metal. This computer is a machine for anything that you can dream up, right? Anything you can encode as a program, as a process. And computers, the history of computers is actually quite interesting because computers used to be
humans.
You
would say that.
Yeah, I would. I'm biased. Yeah. But computers used to be human beings who did computations by hand, right?
Right.
And they could do them very quickly. They could do them with an amazing degree of accuracy. And when the digital computer first came along, and digital was always used in that time to differentiate a computer, which was a human by default, putting digital there is what is required to then say, oh, I'm talking about the machine computer. And at the beginning, these things actually were not that reliable. So, you know, a human computer could even outperform a digital computer. But what happened there was scale. So again, as manufacturing processes improved, we were able to, and technological breakthroughs such as moving from vacuum tubes to actual semiconductors, we were able to make computers faster, cheaper to manufacture, and we could basically make them exponentially better at a rate that soon made a computer much more capable than a human. You still have a problem here at calculations, as we've kind of repeated a few times. You know, a computer, what it is good at is doing calculations really fast, really accurately. But the problem with automating knowledge work is, okay, the computer is now, the digital computer is now a tool by which you can automate knowledge work. But in order to do that, you need to still, as we said, turn work into a process, and you need to encode that into a series of instructions that the computer executes. And there are people that do that encoding, and they're called programmers. So, you know, there's still something kind of standing between the knowledge factory owner and the end product. You still have these highly skilled machine operators called programmers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the history of computing is full of twists and turns, both in hardware and in software. one of the things we talked about, I think last time or the time before, was this switch out from machine code where we're just putting in ones and zeros and very sort of small, low level programming to higher level programming. So I think the thing that we want to move forward into is like, okay, well, as we're getting higher and higher level programming, we have this challenge essentially is how do we make programming easier for humans,
right,
to express what they want. And so programming languages moved from like these, you know, ones and zeros to this assembly language to eventually kind of what they call high level languages, where you could be not exactly speaking English, but you could like have almost kind of like pseudocode, or you could, well, they call it pseudocode, but you could have more Englishy kind of language to tell the computer what to do.
At each step, you're making programming more accessible to a wider range of people, in theory, right? That's the idea.
Yeah, in theory, yeah. Yeah, it turns out that, you know, underneath everything, at the bottom of it, you kind of still have to, at least until we get to this this current iteration of LLMs, I would say that you have to understand, or the programmers have to understand how the computer works, or yes, how a computer program works, I will say.
Exactly.
Actually.
Yeah.
So I think probably, you know, my generation would understand a bit more about how the actual computer works.
Right.
I think there's a general sort of lamenting in younger. we heard it from our little backstage group that we have some younger people there, and they're who are going through university now, and they sort of like say, "Oh my God, you know, we don't get to know like some of these details," and you know, things like iPads and iPhones aren't as amenable to understanding how these things actually work. But leaving that to one side, as you say, we're getting more and more accessible programming environments. You know, people want to be able to teach kids how to program. They want to be able to teach older adults. They want to be able to teach, you know, a whole variety of people how to program. And it's definitely been a huge challenge, mostly because the instructions for a computer have to follow a certain pattern. And if you don't do it right, the computer will behave in a bizarre way. And then you have to work out what the hell went wrong between, well, what did I say wrong, essentially? It's kind of like, it's like a conversation with somebody who kind of like is on a different wavelength to you completely.
Right.
You know,
right.
You say something and it offends them. And you're like, what did I say? Can you help me to understand what I said that was so offensive? And the computer, it's kind of like, I mean, it is a bit like that. The computer is trying to help you to say, okay, well, actually, you said this at this line, which offended me. And you're like, oh, okay. I see. Right. Now I see how it offended you. So I'll rewrite it. I misspoke there, you know.
Right.
And that's how, like, I mean, this is a very reductive way of talking about programming, but that's kind of how it is. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you try and tell a computer to do something in the language that you choose, the programming language that you choose, and then you either get it right or you get it wrong, you know. And when you get it wrong, it might be immediately observable, or it might be only observable later on. And that's a definition of a bug, obviously, where, you know, the computer is doing something that you've told it to do, but actually is a very subtle misinterpretation, an edge case or something that you didn't quite account for,
right?
But that your program misbehaves around. So yeah, so all of these things to do with the complex nature of processing, the complex nature of programming, they're assisted through this programming languages and programming environments. And now we're getting to the LLMs, where the idea is that you can, rather than just type in the programming language, you can start to type in English, essentially, and say, I want the program to do this. I want the program to show me a web page that logs me into a website. And it feels quite like a very attractive proposition, I would say.
Yeah, it does. And I think the very attractive proposition, so it's attractive to two sets of people, right? It's attractive to the people, you know, the owners of the knowledge factories who want to employ fewer humans, right? Because now I only need a small set of people, you know, telling the large language model what to do. But it's also attractive to knowledge workers ourselves, because what we're being sold again is this idea that the LLM, ChatGPT or whatever, can remove tedium and toil from our jobs. So an LLM is different from a computer in that you no longer, as you were saying, you no longer, so the narrative goes, let's be very careful to say, you no longer have to be very precise. You know, now you can, as a programmer, yeah, you can say, I want a program or I want an app that looks like this, that does that. As a copywriter, you can say, I want a marketing pitch that conveys this message that causes this emotion in the reader, you know, as a this, as a that. So now LLMs unlock automation of all knowledge work. So they're even more general than the computer, because now you don't have to be as skilled, you know, as the programmer. You don't have to encode these rules very specifically. You don't have to, as you said, you don't have to be so careful to avoid offending the machine. Because now the machine, like, somehow knows your heart. It knows your intention, and it just does your bidding. So the really strange question to me here, or sorry, not strange, the really strange thing to me here is that these knowledge workers are effectively participating and automating themselves out of a job. They're kind of sowing the seeds of their own unemployment here. So, you know, I think the question is, like, why are they doing that? And what does using these LLM tools, what is that actually doing to them, you know, on a human level, on an employee level, whatever? And I think, you know, maybe that's the conversation we want to get into next time. But I don't know if you had any kind of closing thoughts on automation before we wrap up.
I think just before we wrap up, I was gonna say that I kind of feel like you've left us on a bit of a cliffhanger there, in the sense that that LLMs will deliver on these promises. I feel like we have to be very cautious there, that I don't think they will.
No.
So what I think in this conversation, what we've talked about is the fact that automation has a harmful effect by default.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We are automating things, and there are harms.
Yep.
Although, you know, like we said, there are perceived benefits.
Perceived and real, I would say.
Perceived and real. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're eating, we're driving cars, we're working with our phones. I mean, these are real things in the real world that are actually benefiting us. But obviously, when you automate things and scale things, you do necessarily reduce quality. I think that's fairly clear from this conversation.
Yes.
The worrying thing, or the thing about quality, is the question is how much can you degrade it before it becomes unacceptable? I think that's the big open question about LLMs to me.
Yeah, that's a great point, Ray. Can't wait to talk to you next week. All right, before we head out this week, we'd like to turn our eyes to our comments section again. And we have a new one on Spotify, Ray, I think.
Yeah, from Chonkin. It's very complimentary. Best episode so far, says Chonkin. I'm a non-programmer, non-tech worker, so these insights really blew my mind and opened my eyes and probably did other things to other parts of my head. Fire, 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 fire emoji. No entry emoji. Fire extinguisher emoji. Yeah, they definitely upped his emoji game, that's for sure.
Well, it's still nothing compared to Samsky, you know, from last week with all of the, I don't even know, 9 of them or something like that.
Maybe they're competing on emoji counts. I don't know. The emoji wars in our comment sections are on fire.
Yeah. I mean, that's great to hear from Chonkin, because that comment we should have said was on the programmers episode. And I know that was one, Ray, where you and I were a little worried. Should we put a disclaimer? Will people who aren't programmers even get anything out of this? So good to hear that at least one chicken out there got something out of it.
Yeah, thanks very much.
And on this same episode, our friend Oscar is also back, and Oscar issues the emojis and gets straight to the point, saying, As someone who's not in the industry, it's interesting to hear about this stuff from people on the inside. Well, thank you, Oscar. As long as you stick with us, you've got the people on the inside to bring you that straight, unvarnished truth. See you next week.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!